and the Council of Ministers of the European governments use this structure, sometimes even to circumvent their own parliaments at home, by taking decisions, saying this is a European decision, there's nothing we can do about it, and ramming measures through their parliaments at home. So sending children to learn what the institutions of Europe are in Brussels is much worse than dressing them up as young pioneers to sing songs on Tito's birthday. At least that didn't harm anyone. But the model is not so different, if you think about it. And where is it all going to take us? This, of course, is dependent on all of you, on us, on citizens, on the new generations that are arising and growing up and beginning to ask more and more questions of why this has happened, of what existed before it, or was everything bad that we argued for before, and how in this age we can move forward. Look, there are no certainties. One can't predict with certainty what is going to happen, except one thing, that the capitalist system is not capable of supplying the needs of a majority of people in the world today. And this affects everything. This affects any policies on the ecological level. People say, what will happen to our grandchildren and great-grandchildren and their great-great-children? Well, we don't know. It could be bad. Because the only way policies on the ecological front can be changed and reshaped is if there is some element of planning in society. Planning within states, interstate planning, planning on a global scale. Otherwise, how can anything effective be done on the ecological front, where turbocharged capitalism is destroying the ecology at a rapid rate? There's been a huge, huge increase in it. Carl Pugliani, in his very great work, the Great Transformation, assumed when he was writing that book in the late 40s that the world could only move forward. He was a socialist, a social democrat of Polish origin, lived in North America. Sorry. I stand corrected, a Hungarian, and a very, very important figure intellectually. And I think it's one of the best books to be written in that period about what would happen to the world unless this future got defined and unless the world moved more and more in that direction. Were he alive, you know, leave alone Marx, were Pugliani alive? And to see the world today, it has regressed from what people like him thought at the time. And this is why the new movements that have arisen and the new generations that are coming into activity in times of grave social and economic crises will, of course, learn through their own experiences. And all I can say is that let's hope that the generations to come will avoid the mistakes that have been made by the left in the past, will learn from those mistakes, and will develop or struggle for a form of society which transcends both the existing capitalist order and the so-called socialisms that existed in the 20th century. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it working? Yeah. Thank you, Tariq, for the inspiring lecture again. Now we have half an hour, I think, for questions from the audience. Just raise the hand, and here is one hand already, here in the first row. He was the fastest. Please be short and pose questions and not comments, if you can.
Yes, I have a concrete question, but I don't know how the answer will be concrete. When it comes to free movement of goods, the free trade, and the terrible conditions under which they are created, which ultimately affect the quality of life over here in Europe, what is, in your opinion, the outcome? Will the European Union finally ironically colonize itself eventually in order to stay competitive on the market, or do we put an embargo on the on these products that are made under horrible conditions in our
Well, you can't put an embargo on anything that is produced at the moment in China or in India or places like that, because the financial institutions will not let you do it. The World Trade Organization fights tooth and nail to stop any embargoes on that. So that, I don't think, is going to work. Though I will say this, that if a country or a region decides to change course and defy the financial institutions and the big powers, they can do many, many things. What do I mean when I talk about regions? Look, in Europe, it serves the needs of the big European countries. Let's just talk about Europe for a minute, to have tiny little states which they can dominate. Let's be blunt. What are these states? They are de facto colonies. It's a rude word, but they are. You know, Croatia, Serbia, colonies, EU colonies, Bosnia, Kosovo, protectorates, officially protectorates till now. So wouldn't it make more sense to think again, not to recreate the old Yugoslavia or go for Yugostalgia or anything like that, but to think what would create a strong region in this area which would be able to struggle for its interests and the interests of its people effectively, even within the structures of the European Union. I'm not advocating they walk out of the European Union. I think a Balkan confederation, which includes all the former Yugoslav republics, as well as Greece, as well as Bulgaria, as well as Albania, is something which should be considered. It's in the interests of all of them. The Greeks, or the Greek elite, used to say, and they're still saying, by the way, how can we leave the euro, because this is what has made us European. If it takes a piece of paper to make you European, then you're in a very sad state indeed. And if we give up this piece of paper, we will be like the third world, they say. They don't want to say Africans, because it's a bit rude, though some extreme right people say that. But they say we will be like the third world. But this is complete nonsense. You know, this is to accept fate. So I think what you suggest is possible only if you have large blocks within Europe. I just don't want to mention I mentioned the Balkan Federation because I'm here. You can have a Northern European bloc too, of the Scandinavians and independent Scotland and Ireland. Or if the English want to come in, though they won't because they're so closely attached. You know, I don't want to be rude now, but they're so closely attached to the United States that they can't think of anything else. That is their primary affiliation, not to the European Union, but to the across the Atlantic. So we are now in a situation of turbulence, and we have to think bravely and boldly. And I think a Balkan confederation, economically, politically, socially, culturally, is a good idea. It will be attacked because many of the elites, it's not in their interest, but it is in the interest of the common people, and then it can something like these issues being raised, can be done. The other thing is this, that in these countries which produce goods in horrible conditions, what we have to really struggle for, we can struggle for it in the abstract by writing about it and arguing in its favor, but what the people of these countries have to do and struggle for is trade union rights, rights of self-organization, so they can defend their own interests. They do it, but they are crushed. They do it in India, but you have such a large reserve pool of labor that it becomes difficult. In China, it's not allowed. You're not allowed to, you know, I mean, their trade unions are official bodies which are attached to the state. That would be the most effective way of improving conditions. And people who get worked up, you know, sometimes about immigration, by the way, they never understand why people migrate. You know, why did a million Greeks migrate to Australia? Why? Why did Germans in the mid-19th century migrate to the United States? There are always reasons, economic reasons, for it. And unless the world is improved as a whole economically, you will always have migrations from poor countries to rich countries where people try and find work. I mean, there are many, many people, Croats, Serbs, etc., also in Australia, by the way. They left for, many of them left for political reasons. They didn't like the new Yugoslavia. And they took their politics there with them. but some went for purely economic reasons. So the answer to your question is that it's not something we can achieve immediately, but it has to be fought for on many different levels, both in Europe and in countries like China and India.
There is another question, and can you please raise your hands if there are other ones? Yeah, in the upper part of cinema.
I have a question for you, just to criticize basically capitalism on various aspects, and I pretty much agree with everything you said. We have a lack of democratic, we have actually a democratic deficit in Europe and lack of accountability when decisions are made on the top of the European Union. But at the same time, this more extreme types of socialisms can be easily criticized, especially in the South America. We have Venezuela, where is also the question and the legitimacy of the decision very questionable, and also it's a just illusionary democracy of the people. What I'm more interested in is, of course, you said that Hayek, if I'm right, mentioned at the beginning that his platform was to stay within the economic union, but just practically to stay politically independent. And it reminded me on the example of Switzerland. And I'm actually asking you what we can learn from there. Because in Switzerland, we have a country which is part of economic union, but it's politically completely, in a sense, independent, and there is actually the best type of democracy that we now have in Europe, because people are asked every time on everything there. So people participate all the time. They're part of an economic union, and which is very important is that Switzerland today has very strong social component, very strong redistributional mechanisms, and people there live pretty well, I think. So do you think that this is an example we can learn from? And I mean, it's I will mention one more time that still Switzerland is a capitalistic country, the country that did not experience the same failures that most of the countries in the EU had.
The first response I would make is I disagree with you very fundamentally about South America. I have been there many, many times myself, so I don't even talk from in an abstract way, and seen with my own eyes what has changed and what hasn't changed in those countries. They shouldn't be idealized, but what has happened in South America is being noticed and commented on by everyone. It's not illusory democracy, it's a very real democracy. When Chavez gave, when the Bolivarians in Venezuela had a new constitution, the oligarchic elite opposed it. We don't want it. It was voted through with a majority, large majority. Then they used that same democratic constitution to try and get enough signatures to have a recall vote. It's the only constitution in the world which permits a certain number of signatories of citizens to say we want new elections. New elections. And the same opposition that had refused to vote for the constitution now used it to demand new elections. And they had them. They got enough signatures. And there were new elections. And the Americans sent many people to observe these elections, which they never do in Saudi Arabia, by the way. They sent people to observe these elections. Jimmy Carter is Center for Human Rights. And Carter said, publicly after these elections, "These are the freest elections I have ever seen," he said. By which I mean he included in his own country, because after all he was elected president too. So it's the campaign of vilification against the South Americans was so strong. Why is it that every single mainstream newspaper in Europe wrote exactly the same thing about these countries, especially the Venezuelans, because they had oil money? Exactly the same thing. That's democracy. Whether you read The Guardian or The Financial Times or The Economist or El País, which was particularly vicious, or Le Monde, which was equally vicious, with the exception, I have to say, of the German press that was more balanced, the rest and the American press, exactly the same thing, as if one central office was churning all this stuff out and they were putting different glosses on it and publishing it. And the reason they were nervous is that these people were challenging the neoliberal system. I give you, forget Venezuela. A Spanish company in Argentina is about to go under. The Spanish owners of that company are negotiating with the Chinese to buy the company. The government of Cristina Kirchner finds out what the Chinese are going to pay. She doesn't want a foreign country to have this anymore. She finds out exactly what the Chinese have offered. The Chinese tell them. And they nationalize the company and give compensation which is exactly the same as the Chinese were about to pay them. And the Spanish government goes berserk. This is dictatorial. This is authoritarian. Then a week later, Evo Morales does exactly the same thing in Bolivia. Now, I call that rather exciting, actually, that these countries are not, they don't have to ring up the Treasury Department in Washington or the Chancellery in Berlin and say, "Excuse me, could you mind if we do this?" No, they do it. That's what I call sovereignty, and that's what I call independence. Look.
And there is a bit more from that and the Q&A, but I had to trim them to fit them into the show. We're now going to hear American political commentator and author of America Beyond Capitalism. This is Gar Alperovitz.
I have very strange feelings about following these guys talking on the screen. And let me just talk about that so we can put this in perspective. I worked, as Sarah mentioned, I was a legislative director in the U.S. Senate for Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day. I was also a legislative director and directed staffs in the House. And I have a very checkered career. You know, this is bad. I worked at the highest level of the State Department doing policy planning for the United Nations policy. That was in the past. So I come out of straight politics, although I'm a Wisconsin kid, so I come out of Wisconsin politics, which is a pretty progressive form of liberalism. And I've left that world some time ago. And I honor it. I'd rather have Obama in office, and I'd rather have a good liberal program going. I prefer that. I think it would be important for us. But what I've listened to these guys, in particular Romney, who, you know, give me a break. It's like a little kid in school, bang, 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 bang. But also Obama, the trap that we can get lost in, and it's a hard one to grasp, but I think that they are working in such a constrained space. What they are allowed to talk about, what they may care about, and what we are allowed to hear is itself so limited that it tells you that there is a profound, deeper problem, a systemic problem, that has constrained the whole discussion, both of what is possible and where we are in history and what we might do. So it just corners us. And that was my first reaction. So for instance, this is the wealthiest economy in the history of the world. It currently produces, with massive unemployment and massive recession, $192,000 for every family of four. There is no economic problem. Let me say that again. We do not have an economic problem. We have a political problem managing the wealthiest system in the history of the world. Those numbers will go up and up, and if we can handle the resource questions, the technology will continue to generate about a sevenfold increase over the century as it did in the last century. So the most bountiful possibility, even in a time of resource scarcity, is lost. We can't even think about it. And it becomes utopian just to say what economists know the numbers are. So put it another way. What can't be said, and the first part of this talk up briefly to say why we are in a very unusual systemic crisis, and why, if we understand that, it might allow us to move in a different direction. The first part, I want to get that briefly on the stage, and then talk about what I think is really interesting, the positive things that are exploding per force of necessity out of the pain of the crisis, building forward in a way that I think is really interesting. But in terms of the crisis itself, how do you tell a systemic crisis? It's not only about the way the chatter is in the political sphere. If you see wages going steadily down and the top income for 30 years, 30 long trends tell you there's deeper mechanisms at work. So, for instance, over 30 years, the top 1% has increased its share by 10%, meaning the bottom 99% has lost that, but it's a steady trend over time. Something's driving it. Power relationships are driving it. The number that I find most unusual and gives you a sense of what is systemic about it is the top 400 people, individuals, 400 people, could get them in this space if you squeeze just a little bit, have more wealth now than the bottom 180 million Americans taken together. That's a medieval number. I don't mean that rhetorically. I mean medieval society was structured with the ownership of wealth, in that case land, at that level of concentration and giving it power relationships of that kind. If you look at a different question, people have looked at civil liberties. If you want to know what liberty is about, you actually look to see who gets deprived of their liberty. And if you look at the long trends, which tell you about underlying mechanisms, the United States started about 30 years ago, 50 people per 100,000 in jail. It's now up to 743 over time going up. A lot of black and brown people there. We have 8 times as many people in prison or jail per capita than any other advanced country, including Russia. The loss of liberty is a trend. We see it in terms of the legal and civil liberties, right? You can go into the legal matters of it, but just look at the bottom indicators. Climate change. Over the last 30 years, the increases in the various forms of gas that are increasing global warming have gone up steadily. In the last 2 years alone, 3%. And you all know the numbers. There is no trend change. It's all going in the wrong direction. So something is generating the larger trends that you see, and they are not being ameliorated. There is a problem with the power level of power. So that presents kind of, they can't manage the economy in, let me just give you one last one just as a stagnation question. People often look at economists and don't quite know all these numbers, deficits and so forth. I think the best person who ever explained to me how to think about the economy was my Aunt Isabel from Racine, Wisconsin, where I'm from. She was a baker. She ran a little baker shop. And she remembers, she said, you know, during the Depression, there wasn't much money around. And then they had a big war, and all of a sudden, there's lots of money around. And the point of it was that it is not beyond the capacities of policy to run an efficient economy. It is beyond the capacities of the politics and the political structure, which makes it a systemic problem. In most political systems, the way in which the power of the corporation and the elites has been balanced throughout the Western world, it's studied to death by political economists, is that it is not only politics and movement building and organizing for elections that allows some balance to the system against the 400 and the corporations they own. It is, in fact, an institution, and that institution has been the labor movement. Throughout the Western world, strong labor movements have allowed the election, even of environmentalists like Gaylord Nelson. You needed the labor institution, and that's why Governor Walker in Wisconsin and every Republican governor is going after labor, because if they cut that out, that institution, they pulled the muscle out from under any kind of progressive politics. So they know what the game is, and they know just what the political economists know. And what's happened, and why the oddity of the systemic crisis needs to be looked at in a new way, I think, is that, in fact, labor has gone down from 35.4% of the labor force in unions in 1953 at the peak It's now at 11% and declining, less than 7% in the private sector, and will go further down. If you want to ask one simple question about why the system has no capacity to manage and why the underlying trends are increasing in the direction they're increasing, it's that the old balancing mechanisms that worked sort of in the third quarter of the 20th century and then began to decay over the next 30 years, it is the decline of labor and the decline of that institution, which has pulled the whole system in a different direction. This is not just corporate capitalism. Throughout the Western world, it has been corporate capitalism balanced sort of by parties politically resting on the institution of labor. And that is dying. That is the name of the American systemic crisis as it deepens. For all of the problems and advantages of labor, that's what's going out the window, and that's where the trends are. There's a lot of reasons why labor's gone down. The most, they've been attacked. There have been race issues at the bottom of a lot of this. We could get into that. There's the Chinese, there's the trade problems, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing to notice is that the system has lost its old way of managing a liberal political economy. And we are facing the trend result of that. A systemic crisis is one that doesn't get solved by politics as usual. To put it another way, is there any institutional way to alter the trends other than build a movement? You need a movement. Absolutely. But we also know historically that unless we build new institutions with power over time, they win. And it could get very ugly. Now, what makes it a very odd and strange crisis, and then we'll go on to what's interesting about what's happening. But the context is critical, and I think as a historian, so I have to burden you with this. It is, my Marxist friends see all this, and they say there will be a crisis, and a collapse, and maybe a revolution. Now, I honor some of the really good Marxist thought. But what's interesting about this particular crisis is, in 1929, the economy was supported by a government that was 11% of the GDP, not very big. And the crisis was the collapse. There was no floor. The floor now is 34%. We may get decay and stalemate and stagnation, but we're not likely to get that collapse that's going to cause a big explosion, in my opinion. There's also the problem that a big explosion might go to the right rather than the left. But the most important point is we may get the stagnation that you're seeing and stalemates politically and ongoing decay, but that's a very different context. It's a very unusual context, so a minute just to think about it, and I burden people with this. It isn't a period of reform where the trends are moved forward in the old way, but it's not a period where there's a crisis collapse, like the Depression or a Marxist theory. It's very unusual. It's decaying and stalemated and stagnating, and what we experience day to day, unemployment, underemployment, poverty, global warming, environmental issues all over the place. Odd, painful, but strange crisis. And I want to stress to you that it's important, I think, to grasp the nature of how odd it is, because it has certain properties. One of which is the pain levels are forcing people to do new things because they have to. In a crisis, that isn't what happens. You get explosions. But what we're seeing, and this is the part that's very interesting to me, what we're seeing is an explosion of activity, both political, some social, but above all economic, in a way that I think could matter. Now, let me say a bit about that. All systems run on the basis, one way or another, of property. And in this one, the property concentrations are, as I've said, extreme and getting worse. The medieval ones, as I said, land was at the core of it. 19th century capitalism, small business ownership of capital was the dominant form of a very strange kind of competitive capitalism. Corporate capitalism comes in different flavors. Corporate domination at the end of the 19th century was pretty much just corporate power. The balancing game that the mid-century and all the advanced countries and now decaying social democracy or liberalism, it was called. That was another form of corporate capitalism. Still another one was fascism, corporate capitalism with repression. But the decay we're seeing, but at the core of these systems all is the question of property, who owns the wealth. And simply as one element of the way to think about what might be the possibilities of the next system and what might be the possibilities of building institutional power and displacing, pushing back over time the dominant power of the system, it would have to revolve, I think, and we could have a long discussion, around some way to democratize the ownership of wealth. If it's 1% or 400 people owning as much as the bottom 180 million, or 1% now owning more investment capital, this one's another. 1% owns now more investment capital than the bottom 95% of the society. Either there is a way to democratize the ownership of wealth, or it stays as is. And either there's a way to do it in a democratic, decentralized way, or you end up with statism of the Soviet Union style. The conservatives are right about that. The state owning the capital under state socialism, as it was practiced, did concentrate power. So there's our problem. Stagnation, stalemate, decay. If you want another system, let me press you on this. We haven't done this, you and I. What is it that you want? You don't like this system? What do you want? It's no good to say change the system and then say, well, we need to think it through. And one element, and it's a real challenge to all of us, one element of it, in my view, is how do we begin decentralizing the ownership of wealth, both as a principle and democratizing it, but also as a way to begin step by step to building new power bases and new cultural bases in the system. What I just said in the 60s would have been called a heavy rap. What does it look like? And how do we begin to think about it? I don't think anybody's got the real answer to this. I don't expect that. But I think directions are beginning to emerge largely because of the odd structure of the crisis and its pain levels that is forcing people to innovate. Here's a website for you. Community-wealth. Put the dash in. There's another one without. It's a different one. It's a good one, but it's not this subject. And what we look at is what's going on at the grassroots level and around the country that is beginning to suggest a direction for changing the ownership of wealth in a democratic form. So when you begin to look, some odd things that come up first. There are 130 million Americans now involved in co-ops and co-op credit unions. 130 million people who have some involvement in a cooperative institution, one person, one vote. Many of those are credit unions. I was in Burlington, Vermont a couple months ago, and the Occupy movement was looking at the credit union, which is many credit unions, let's be honest, they're very boring, standard. They aren't doing much interest. They could. They're one person, one vote. The light bulb went on. Why don't they fund interesting worker-owned co-ops or other really interesting projects could be funded with some of the capital that's in those credit unions? So a number of these folks became members and voted in some new board members. You could do that, by the way. So interesting thing going on. But 130 million people already involved in one-person, one-vote co-ops. There are 10 million people, 11 million actually, involved in 10,000 worker-owned companies around the country. Some good, some bad, some that could be better, but they're on the ground and they exist and nobody knows about it. There are 4 or 5,000 neighborhood-owned corporations around the country. Some good, some bad, some very interesting indeed. We could talk about some large-scale ones. There are 100, the last number I saw was 1,300 people working in New Communities, Inc. in New Jersey, making money on a community-based structure and using the money to hire other people for social services, healthcare, etc., in a mini-ownership, democratized ownership structure. That's another one. There are social enterprises popping up everywhere in which profits are being turned into social good. There are more and more of these kinds of elements, all of which share the idea somehow to change and democratize the ownership and use of wealth in a radically decentralized way. Now, what's interesting to me is, first, just to notice this. This is one phenomena that's happening. And second, to watch the path of development. And this is the thing I would suggest you do. Probably there's a lot of it going on here. I know there's some work going on with Slice, and I'm just beginning to hear about some of the other things going on in this community. But every place we've gone, there is a phenomena that isn't quite spoken of as a phenomenon. It's just good projects. But if you look at it slightly back, what you see is a trend line of development and sophistication and increasing sophistication and a path that is beginning to build towards innovation and power. Now, let me give you some personal example of that, give you this idea of how I think about it as a historian and how I propose you think about it with me, because my own view is that we're building into the prehistory of the next great American Revolution and what we are doing. Just as in the 2 decades before the New Deal, we are developing experimentally, in my view, the potential for the great transformation that could come if we're serious. But let me tell you what I see in states like Ohio, because it gives you a kind of a model or a template of this. I was involved with the steelworkers in 1977 in Youngstown, Ohio. The first big steel closing in the United States, Youngstown Sheet and Tube closed, 5,000 people were thrown out in the street. That was huge news in 1977 because it hadn't been happening. Now it happens every day, but in those days it was a big deal. And the workers and the churches and the ecumenical coalition in that town, they knew the town was going to go down, and Youngstown has gone down since. So they said, why can't the steelworkers, why can't we run this? Why can't we have a worker-owned company, 5,000 guys? Why can't we do it? There were mostly guys. There were very few women in those days. And so they organized, and they got the Carter administration to back them up with enough money to come up with a very, very sophisticated plan and a promise of $100 million in loan guarantees. Did very good political work around an idea. I just learned, by the way, that when Obama was organizing as a young organizer in Chicago, what he was working on was a steel mill inspired by the Youngstown case. Someone's doing a history of his early days. But the Youngstown story was a big story in those days. And they put on the map this real plan. They got even the conservative governor forced into supporting it. And then, of course, after the election in 1978, the money disappeared. And the Carter administration backed off and did the usual political thing. And they didn't get their money. However, and this is what's interesting about it for those of you who want to play this game, they understood that they might lose this game. You want to play for big stakes? You don't always win. And so they did a huge political education project along with what they were doing. And now in the state of Ohio, you probably have more worker-owned companies than in any other state per capita all over the place, because they understood the task was to build for the long haul as well as what they were doing. So second thing, the International Steelworkers Union in 1977 saw these young activist upstart union guys in Youngstown. And they didn't want them getting their jobs back. They played a rough game. They said, these guys are going to win that game. They're going to challenge us at the international level. We're going to have trouble. What do we need those guys for? They fought, the international union fought the local guys and said, so they lose their jobs. People were going out in the garage and killing themselves, their families at that point. And the international's view was, we're not going to do this. And though no one can prove it, but we think that they and the steel companies went together to the Carter administration to kill the deal after the election. But in any case, they were publicly opposed to it. Played a rough game. Now, 30 years later, do you think as a historian or as an activist or maybe even a revolutionary? Now the steel workers have come around. And the steel workers are now working hard to set up worker-owned companies. That's happening in many unions, by the way. That's a big tilt because they realize that they are, either there's a new direction that builds institutional power, not just politics, that democratizes the ownership of wealth, really, worker-owned companies in that case, or the game's over. So the steel workers over time have flipped. And in the state of Ohio, there's all these worker-owned companies that came out of this interesting fight. More interesting still, there's innovation building on it. And this is how I see it in terms of developmental thought, and urge you to think about it this way. In the city of Cleveland, now I don't know if any of you have been to Cleveland later, or Detroit, or St. Louis, or Baltimore. They look like bombed out cities. You know, Detroit, where my wife is from, 1 million people gone. And they all look at Detroit and say, my God, it's terrible. They also don't ask, where did the people go? Where did they go? Nobody cares. It's, oh, Detroit. But in any case, Cleveland lost 300,000 people, from 900,000 to almost 400,000 people. In one of the poorest neighborhoods of Cleveland, this is Ohio. What I mean by poor neighborhood, the average family income is $18,000. 40% unemployment, high level of crime, extreme poverty. In that area, there is a development in complex of very sophisticated worker-owned firms, not small scale, building over time and building a whole complex that is extremely innovative, building on the experience of development gone on over the last 30 years and adding to it. So for what do I mean by that? So for instance, they are just about to open the largest greenhouse, urban greenhouse, partly solar in the United States. These are not tokens. 3 million heads of lettuce a year will be its output. Cleveland is an area that in Ohio imports almost all of its lettuce, for instance, from the West Coast, on enormous carbon costs and enormous waste and a very great cost. And they are now setting up worker-owned advanced company. Another one, the solar installation company, worker-owned, is about to install over the next 2 years double the capacity of solar capacity in the entire state of Ohio. They will put in twice as much in the next 3 years. Worker-owned company. And another one of them, the greenest laundry in the entire Midwest, uses about a third of the energy and a third of the water. It's an industrial-scale laundry, can serve hospitals and so forth. Is on the ground in a platinum LEED building, and it is also worker-owned and it's part of this complex. Moreover, they've taken the idea of worker ownership to a very different level. This is democratizing wealth. Worker-owned companies, I'm an advocate of worker-owned companies and co-ops, but I don't get too romantic about them. The plywood companies that Sarah was talking about have been well studied. Worker-owned companies tend to sometimes become very insular and just protect the workers in that company without interest in the community, and often without environmental interest. Sometimes, and in the case of the plywoods, if you looked at the profile, their politics was Republican. So worker-owned companies on their own may be positive, they may be negative, but one has to be thoughtful about it. But what's interesting about the Cleveland model is that they are linked together with a community vision. So it's a nonprofit corporation that owns part of these companies. They can't get up and leave. That 10% of their profits go back to a revolving fund to set up new companies. They're going to do about 2 a year. The goal is 5,000 over the next 15 years. And they're building a community building structure, integrating worker ownership into a different model. That's really interesting. That is very interesting. If those of you interested in design problems, you want to design a system and you think community and community importance, there's a real interesting model there. And again, for those of you who want to talk about what's the system look like, tell me about it. Well, here's another feature of this Cleveland development. You probably didn't hear about it. The press doesn't cover this stuff. In that neighborhood, with that level of poverty, there are big hospitals and universities. Cleveland Clinic was mentioned tonight. Cleveland Clinic is right there, right in the middle of this poor neighborhood. University Hospital is there. Case Western Reserve is right there, right in the middle. They have a lot of public money, Medicare, Medicaid, education funds. They purchase in that particular area $3 billion, with a B, not an M, of goods and services a year, leaving aside their salaries, and leaving aside their construction budget, just what they buy, none of it from that area until now. So all of a sudden, the light bulb's gone. Why don't we use this enormous publicly funded purchasing power to help stabilize and buy from these co-ops and build out the whole system and develop it? And that is, in fact, what's now happening in this area and in Atlanta and in Pittsburgh and in Washington, D.C., and in Amarillo, Texas, of all places. Very conservative, picking up on this model. And there are discussions following it in Milwaukee and Chicago and several other cities looking at this model. Now, it's the greenest model, and it democratizes wealth. And very interesting to me as a political economist, and let me urge this on you, some of you who want to think about models, want to think about if you don't know where you're, what is it you want, and if you don't know, why should we listen to you? You want to change the system? That model is very interesting because it is a partial planning system, purchasing power, stabilizing worker-owned companies in a community-building design, still using part of the market to keep them in check. That's not state socialism. That's not corporate capitalism. It is a mini version of a systemic design of a very sophisticated order. We could go into that if we had time, but think about it. And think about this. The politics of it is working. Even the small businessmen like it. You get below the level of ideology at Washington, you get back to Racine, Wisconsin, where I'm from, and you talk to the kids I went to high school with, very conservative, very smart, and they get it. It helps the community. It changes ownership. Why not? It's very American as well. But it is also an extremely interesting design if you project it up. So, for instance, we've been writing about this and doing research on it. In our next system, which will have a lot of mass transit and high-speed rail, all publicly paid for, and all publicly paid for, and we have no capacity whatsoever to build it now in the United States. We import what we do. We do some assembly for the French and for the Italians who have companies and the Germans. When we have that vision, we will have a big, big, big contracts, and somebody's going to build it, public money. And it could well be worker community-owned structures, just upscaling what's going on in Cleveland, using that planning principle in those markets. So that's just a sketch of how you begin to think of the political economy of the next system. If you don't like capitalism, you don't like socialism, you want to move in a new direction, etc. It's a community-building structure based on changing the ownership of wealth. But I digress. That's a long vision. What's interesting to me is the process that you see, and I've sketched all too briefly, in Ohio, is a process that I believe you're going to see happening or could happen. This is where we come in, or could happen when we actually rise to the knowledge that we actually could make a difference moving to the level of systemic change. It can be done anyplace. Now, that's only one model, but the conditions in Ohio are being replicated in many parts of the country. And in my view, come back to the beginning of this discussion, in a context of ongoing stalemate, stagnation, and decay, rather than collapse, which could go to the right just as easily as the left, and rather than reform, which was the old thing we liberals were able to do for a little while when we still had a labor movement, but in this odd, strange place where the pain levels increase and the decay increases, people get that either they invent and create or it gets worse. And then there's some interesting models. Some of them, I mean, there's a whole other side of this, which wonderful things going on in smaller co-ops and green and the food movement and the cultural aspects of this. All this ties in building community in many other forms. But some of the structural ingredients of actually a political economic system that could, in fact, get us the kind of ideas we want in place are also beginning to suggest themselves out of real experience and out of the pain levels of this odd context. Now, I'm not naive. I've run political real campaigns. I've been in the middle of Washington. I'm hip. I get it. So I'm also cynical. I do not take ideas about you can change the system seriously in utopian ideas without some bit of thought. So a suggestion to you. Most of us have a built-in notion that we really can't. I'm talking to the person in your chair. Who, us? Change the system? Now, I don't mean rhetorically. I mean as a real, viable, doable thing, like other people have done in many other countries, that we might actually do something like that and alter the power relationships in the most powerful corporate capitalist system in the history of the world. So my suggestion to you is that, yes, that's the question on the table. And it is not beyond human capacities to think about it in a rational way. So my suggestion to you is this possibility. One of the other things that's happening in the development of these projects, I've been emphasizing the ones that democratize ownership that are popping up out of the pain levels. But there are many other forms, and many of them much more very interesting, the kind that I talked about earlier in terms of the food movement and other environmental parts of this. But one of the things that's also happening, and it's at the level of what people call the sociology of knowledge, or the Germans call Weltanschauung, like worldviews, out of this is also coming a process which is grinding up the traditional worldview. People don't believe anymore in the old stuff. They don't quite believe, if you elect either one of these guys, and I'm for Obama, that much is going to change. It's a very big deal when people don't believe the old stuff. It's a very big deal when it doesn't quite register anymore. That is to put it in different language, what I think you're seeing is a legitimation crisis in this formative years. A legitimation crisis is one in which the guiding ideals of the system, liberty, equality, democracy, ecological sustainability, when those ideals are contradicted by the reality of the trends, then the legitimacy of the existing system becomes eroded because the real world does not fulfill the ideas that give legitimacy to the system. And then people say something's wrong. I believe we're entering a period where people, even the Tea Party, liberty, there's a lot of nonsense going on, but there's also this concern about liberty, that some of it's real. A system that begins to enter that phase historically is really at a place where people can begin either to make a difference or, you know, it could go a different direction. So that's the negative. But the positive is what's happening on the ground, and particularly among young people, where a whole different vision of how to live and how to build society and how to build relationships and culture and the environment and projects, that's also developing not only in what I call projectism, lots of projects, it's developing an idea system. It's developing the preliminaries of a vision of what we might want that is heavily oriented to community, to ecological sustainability, to a different way of treating each other, and to some ideas about democracy and democratization as well. So it isn't only the stuff on the ground that I see bubbling up and that the press doesn't cover, and I see advancing to more and more levels of sophistication, and then the unions coming in and picking up, and that process that isn't being covered, and which would take decades to develop its power. It is the double-level declining vision of ideas at the level of the sociology of knowledge or legitimation crisis, and also a recurring buildup of where we're going to take this. A majority of people between the ages of 18 and 30, when asked do you prefer capitalism or do you prefer socialism in the most recent surveys, a majority say socialism. Odd. I don't think they know what they mean by that term. I don't think it tells you much. It tells you something that people don't believe the old stuff. Amazing. Those are the people who are going to build, people like us are getting on. People in that age are going to build the next society. And people are open, I think, to thinking big thoughts over time. So my suggestion to you is this. There are several, if the processes I'm talking about, and we could add, let me give you some additions to it, because in all this brief, there are many, many states now are trying, there are 20 states that have introduced legislation to try to set up state banks like the State Bank of North Dakota. Another 20 states have set up legislation, are considering legislation to do single payer, like it's going to happen in Vermont, and it was twice vetoed. It passed the House and Senate in California, it was vetoed twice by Schwarzenegger. What's happening at that level of institutions, banks and healthcare, I believe is going to intensify healthcare, particularly because the cost pressures are so severe that the only way you can get at it is single payer, and it'll probably be done state by state. And some of the big corporations will be for it too because it changes their cost structure in international competition. It is possible that if people like us actually can say, really begin to get serious about this stuff, we may be able to, in practice and in ideas and in culture and in institution building, lay down the foundations, irrefutable and irreversible, possible, so that this becomes the genuine prehistory of a transformation. That's also one of the logical possibilities. So that's obviously the one to bet on, but not too lightly, please. I did mean that about the existential issue. My experience in myself and in my friends and in most of the people I know is that we don't quite really want to take ourselves that seriously.
And I trimmed a bit here so we could hear the conclusion.
I'm just doing my project here. It's a nice project. Really good friends. What are you saying? Besides all governments and states and all, they never work. If they don't work, they will control us. So, yeah, that's what I said before, heavy rep. By the way, I'm speaking to the person sitting in your seat. So my suggestion to you is, yes, it is possible that we are living in a systemic crisis. It is a very unusual one. It is also generating a whole series of interesting possibilities that begin to suggest power relationships and cultural relationships and practices that could be generalized, and that the context we're entering may very well be such that it may be possible for determined people who take themselves seriously to lay down self-consciously the foundations of the next transformation. I could leave it at that, but I do want to remind you, and probably this is a good place to stop and then we can get into questions, that ain't what those guys were talking about. They're working, and I feel somewhat sorry for them. They're living in, I've lived in Washington, they're living in this little frame of a decaying system, boxed in by the changing power relationships, and not able to actually open up some of the things probably Barack Obama would love to think about, maybe not quite as far as I've been suggesting to you. But the frame is tiny, and the loss of real energy that explodes when people actually get the possibility that they might have, that's also evident in the kind of chitter-chatter. The tone of it all is lost. Because what comes along, I think, and this is the last thing I'll say about this, don't trust me if I ever say that again, because I usually go on. What's interesting about the possibility, and I say this very coldly as a historian, some of you from the 60s will remember this. What's really interesting about the possibility when a viable possibility begins to be taken really seriously is it unleashes extraordinary energy. Movement energy that is something that is powerful when it's palpable when you actually see it happen or part of it. And the women's movement was part of that, the environmental movement for a while, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement of the 60s, explosive. And you see it in some countries where they begin to see a flame is touched. And then you see human energy added to this whole equation of a very different order. But it takes a lot of building up to get there. So just on the final note on that, and this is the last thing I will say about that, you know, Chairman Mao used to say, power comes from the barrel of a gun. And in the 1960s, the American women's movement said something very different. They said, no. Power comes from six women getting together over coffee or something, reading something, talking to each other, digesting the ideas, figuring out a project, and then supporting each other to do it. I think they were right, and I think that is the message for the building of the next American system.
And thank you to Mike McCormack for making that recording from October the 3rd this year. This show and all previous episodes are available for download from our archive at unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this show has helped you sketch out the vision of a world you would like, and I wish you courage in bringing that world about. And the